Welcome to episode 10 of season 2 of the Ubuntu UK podcast. It's Monday the 3rd of August 2009, and in this episode we are going to interview KB Singh from the CentOS team. We'll cover the latest news and events, we'll have some command line love, followed by the second part of our interview with Justin Kirkland. Then we'll do the competition, ecosphere and feedback. I'm Dave, and with me this week is Tony.
Hi Dave.
Hello Tony, how have you been?
Oh, not too bad. I've been doing Ubuntu server upgrades at work. It's been great.
Oh, from what to what?
Dapper to Hardy on the server.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Don't you have a man to do that?
Yeah, I have several men. No, hang on, that sounds wrong. I do those sort of things myself.
Did you do it direct from, because Dapper is LTS and so is Hardy, did you do it direct?
Yeah, using do release upgrade.
And it worked?
Yes. On one server it uninstalled NTP, but other than that it was all good.
Cool. Just out of interest, any reason for doing that? I mean, Dapper is still supported and will be supported for the next few years.
Yeah, just that most of them are web servers, so newer versions of PHP. Some of the applications we're running need them, so nothing. No major real push to do it. Just felt like it was a good time. It's the summer.
Sounds good.
You've got the whole summer to sort it all out.
Yeah, exactly. If I break it, it's all good. Yeah.
In his flip-flops.
And then I've got another 4 years before it goes end of life.
Yeah, okay. Well, that sounds good. Thanks. Alan, what have you been doing?
Loads, actually.
We haven't got time for all of that. Just cherry-pick the best stuff.
Right, okay. That shut me up. Okay, I used DVD rip for the first time.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the thing that you chuck a DVD in and it just rips it, and I thought that was good, even though I'm sure that's probably illegal where I am.
Depends on the DVD. It's one of your homemade DVDs. No, hang on, that sounds wrong as well.
I tried out Jolly Cloud on my E. We'll probably talk more about that later. It's an Ubuntu-derived thing on my EPC.
Yeah, I think we mentioned it earlier in the season, didn't we?
Yes. I reinstalled Mythbuntu.
Ooh.
And I haven't really used it much yet because I don't have my aerial amplifier, but more about that later.
I'll tell you all about that.
And I bought a new Acer Aspire Revo, a cheap computer that's based on that Nvidia Ion thing, the new thing. It's quite good.
Yeah.
We're using it now, and it works on the telly. HDMI, you owe me 50p, Dave, because you said the audio wouldn't work out of the box.
I didn't realise you were intending to use Karmic. I thought you were going to use a stable release.
Now he tries to get out.
You assumed.
Yeah, okay. Now, Simon, what have you been doing?
I have been the Ubuntu UK podcast courier.
Excellent.
Oh, yeah, I heard a bit about this.
Yeah.
What
Adrian
happened?
Adrian, who won the Viglan.
Little computer from last week.
Yeah, lives just about half an hour from me on the road to Devizes. So I got the box off
Mr. Pope.
That's I the had one. It. Yeah, I had it.
And chucked it on the back of my bike because I was going up to Devizes, thrashed on down to Adrian's, pulled up, gave him the box. He was very happy. Yeah, he got the Viglan. I rode away.
Yeah, and it's always nice to meet our audience.
Yeah. It sounds like a superbly executed delivery.
Do you like that? I'm not seeing any problem there.
It was great, apart from about 20 minutes later, he sent me a text message saying, yeah, laugh my ass off. I delivered him a TV power amplifier.
What? Why did you do that?
I've no idea. Ask Popey. You've got a Viglan, haven't you,
Popey? What happened?
I rushed when I came down here. I rushed out the house and I grabbed the first box that a Viglan would normally be in.
It actually does say Viglan on the box.
Yes, and it probably has my address on it. And I gave that to Simon without opening it up and looking at. And what was inside was me having tidied away an aerial amplifier and some cables. So that's what Adrian received.
I suspect he was actually trying to see whether he'd notice or not. Because I wonder whether the actual piece of equipment he received was potentially more powerful.
Possibly.
He was very good about it. So we're going to get the pucker thing to him as soon as we can.
And to be honest, he got off quite lightly, really, because he could have had your old socks in it or anything.
Yes.
Some random box grabbed from your den.
Well, you know, in the future, it might be worth an awful lot of money. A pair of my old socks.
What parallel universe is that in?
Yes.
What else? I've been playing with, IRSSI or IRSI, depending on where you come from.
That's the console-based IRC client,
yeah,
isn't it?
That's right. Getting Twitter and my IM clients up and working again. Twitter on IRC or on IRC I hadn't done before, and Popey said he used it. So, yeah, why not? I was getting sick to death of Gwibber failing. So now it's all in one place. So that's me. What about you, mate? What have you been up to?
Well, I've mainly been sporting quite an interesting cold, actually. It's been keeping me quite bunged up.
Excellent.
So that's been my main interest. And actually, it has had a reduction in my productivity. But yes, that's been quite fun.
Nice.
Snort.
Additionally, I've been working on some other general stuff. Traditionally, at this point, I normally go into too much detail and say what I've been doing. So if I just say I've been doing some stuff...
So as ever, you're going to tell us nothing.
Yeah. So I've been involved with doing web server stuff and doing some additional packaging stuff.
Yeah.
So,
cool.
Captain Elusive. Well done.
Well, I'm trying to get the blend just right. Either I tell you too much detail and to bore you to death.
Well, what's the most interesting thing you've been packaging?
Snot.
Sounds like a fun pack show.
Okay, we've got a guest here, somewhat different from usual. Someone completely, effectively outside the Ubuntu project. And his name is, or he's known as KB Singh, and he represents CentOS for us today. Hiya, how you doing?
Hi, good. How are you guys doing?
Not bad.
Yeah, not too bad, thank you.
First of all, obviously the first question, we're all mainly Ubuntu users, so the first question really is, can you give us a rundown of what CentOS is, or CentOS, I believe is the correct pronunciation, and what its relationship is to Red Hat Linux and Fedora?
Many years back, well, a couple of years back, 4 or 5 years back, Red Hat changed its business policies, where they took their primary Linux offering off the market and they said, look, we're just not going to do something open anymore. And we're going to have a product called RHEL, the Red Hat Enterprise Linux Platform. And they forked off a developer or a targeted distribution called Fedora, which was completely community-driven. And CentOS sort of came up to fill in that void in that it takes what is Red Hat Enterprise Linux and makes it available to people who don't need the support from Red Hat, who can support themselves, or people who just need a platform that they can build an application on. At its core, it's the same source code that goes into RHEL. As far as the users are concerned, it's different in that you don't get the support from Red Hat and you don't get all the business stuff that comes with it, like, you know, the liability insurance and the business insurance and things like that you get from Red Hat. Yeah, so basically, as far as the distribution is concerned, that's what it is.
Okay, something that interests me is that there's another one I'm aware of called Whitebox Linux, which promises to be a similar thing. How does CentOS actually vary from that? Did you know?
Yes, actually, I started using Whitebox before CentOS happened. Whitebox was going to be something very similar to what CentOS is today, except that Whitebox was run only by one guy, and he refused all outside help. And when you've got five people who are using the distribution, one guy is probably enough. But then that becomes 100, 150.
Yeah, sure.
It's a bit hard, and even things like mailing lists became a problem. And then one fine day, he decided he just didn't want to play this game anymore, which worked out really well for CentOS, because that's, most of the developers actually were immigrants from Whitebox.
So what sort of people use CentOS then, as opposed to Fedora?
It's a completely different target game in that most of the people using CentOS tend to be people who just want to put together a system and not have to worry about it too much. So, you know, traditional industries like the hosting business, hosting is a big thing. VoIP is, again, very big. People who are into VoIP are using CentOS quite a bit. People who are doing application development on things like Ruby on Rails and things like that, they tend to be very heavy users of CentOS. And of course, Red Hat does a lot of virtualization stuff, and that all of those technologies percolate down. So again, on the cloud side of thing, and on the virtualization thing, the VPSs on the internet, CentOS has been really big.
Okay, one thing I'm aware of is with a lot of Linux distributions, you get two variants: you get a desktop and a server edition. Do you actually have a desktop edition with CentOS, or is it purely aimed at the server market only?
Well, Red Hat Enterprise Linux has variants. They have a workstation, a desktop, a server, a cluster store, or whatever. We just roll everything into one distribution, and it's left up to the user to see how they want to use it.
So using CentOS, you can install the likes of GNOME, KDE, and the other window managers and such?
Yeah. It's got a full desktop thing. You've got OpenOffice, you've got Firefox, you've got Thunderbird, which are both tracking the latest releases. you've got, you know, even the SNESI graphics and things like that, like Compass and AIGLX and things like that are all included.
So when you take your code base from Red Hat, you strip out all the Red Hat trademarks, I take it, to, you know, so that you're not infringing any of their
yes,
property.
All artwork, which is of course Red Hat copyright, has to go. All trademark stuff has to go. We also remove certain things which are specific to the Red Hat platform. For things like, they have something called RHN, the Red Hat Network. So all of the tools and code included in the distribution to work with RHN is taken out, because you know, we don't want people using CentOS actually hitting the servers and causing traffic to them.
Sure. And as you've been going for a while and you've had a number of releases, is that now pretty much an automatic process? You know which bits need to be ripped out, so you know you end up with your pure, you know, non-Red Hat. I don't want to say the word tarnished, but you know, you end up with your pure CentOS, and is that some sort of automatic programmatic thing?
Yeah, we've got the actual patching inward and outward happens manually. Somebody has to do it themselves.
Wow.
But the amount of code we have to change is not much. It's only about 6% of the overall distribution.
So do you have things that replace Red Hat Update Network and those bits?
Well, we have the CentOS Mirror Network, which works over YUM, which is purely client-end. Red Hat have, of course, RHN, which works in the server-end as well, as in, you know, you get a nice management web UI that you can control your machines with and things like that.
Oh, right, okay. So it's not just a little icon in a system tray. It's a more central... central managed application than that.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
So something you mentioned there, YUM. Now that's the thing you use to actually update. You know, you use to keep your system updated. Without going too much in detail, and you know, try and be fair. What would you say the main differences is between like a Ubuntu and a Debian or such based server compared to a CentOS one?
Okay, I mean, this is more of a religious thing than anything else. But I think if you strip away all of that stuff, you'll find that the whole app setup is good. It implements a policy. I think the big difference is that YUM aims at getting a completely different mindset down to what app does, in that app will try and retain your system's consistency based on localized policy of however your machine is set up. Whereas YUM trusts that the repositories that you're hitting are going to give you that consistency.
Right, okay.
So, which is the primary difference. So it's about a mindset. So you'll find people who've used Debian all their lives just cannot get YUM. And similarly, you'll find somebody who's used YUM or who's used RPM for a little while, they go back to apt and they're like, you know, what's going on? You know, they'll see a new package up there. They'll say, right, I want to update to that package, and apt will refuse to do it because it's going to break something else on your machine.
Right.
Because it's just how the repositories are maintained and, let's say, the ethics or the ethos behind the repository maintenance. Apart from that, they're basically trying to do the same thing. They're trying to give you a mechanism to get new packages on your machine, keep them updated, you know, make sure you've got a means that, you know, if you want to get dependencies in, then that sort of happens. When you remove stuff, it takes away the right things. I think at the basic, they're doing the same thing. It's just
right.
How they do it and the policies they implement are slightly different.
Okay. So you still use it for doing upgrades of packages, but you just have to think slightly differently about, you know, the way you get from where you are to where you want to go, basically.
Yes.
And do you have I'm trying to draw comparisons because I've never really used CentOS. We have a concept of releases every 6 months. Do your releases follow Red Hat releases, or do you have your own releases, or what sort of release cycle do you have?
We basically try and copy Red Hat as much as we can, and we normally say that once they have an update out, or once they have a release out, we'll try and get one out within 3 weeks.
Wow.
Which is something that we've been able to keep till earlier this year when things fell back a little bit, and it took us 6 weeks to get a release out.
That's still pretty good going, though, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And once a release is out, it's there for 11 years. 7 years under a supported model, and I think another three and a half years, where you're very seriously encouraged not to use it. But if you have it in production, then you know you still get support for it.
And Red Hat try to stick to no kernel API changes or ABI changes from one over a period of time within one release, don't they?
That's right. But I mean, they try to. They have broken it once or twice, but for good reasons.
But not as often as we do in Ubuntu.
No, I think again, it's you know, it's a question of having a different target audience.
Right.
Because if you try and implement the sort of the policy that Red Hat is doing into Ubuntu, you'd have loads of users complaining that, you know, it's like if you read about something on the internet and says, you know, this snazzy new graphics card from this company now just works in Linux, and then you go and install CentOS on it, and you're like, well, it's not working. It's quite hard explaining to the guy why it's not working.
Right.
And I think Ubuntu is at a place where they are actually following, you know, the latest kernel updates, the latest stuff up there, stabilizing it and getting a release out every 6 months. So I think if you really want to stay on that edge, then Ubuntu is definitely, you know, going to give you a better first-time user experience.
Cool.
So where do you fit into the CentOS setup then?
I am responsible at the moment for the build services and the package management policies within CentOS.
Okay, so is that the servers that build the binary versions of the packages that people download?
Yes, the entire build system, and it's quite complex in that, of course, we have to track what's happening upstream, and we have to track CVEs, and we have to track the Red Hat Bugzilla.
And what architectures do you build for?
At the moment, what we have in production for CentOS 4 are pretty much all of the upstream architectures. We have x86, of course, x86 64, we've got PowerPC. We've got the Intel Litanium IA64. We've got PowerPC. We've even got S390.
Wow. Oh, wow.
For CentOS 5, at the moment, we only have the 32-bit and the 64-bit Intel platform. But we are building PowerPC and S390 and Itanium as well. So I think by 5.4, which should be another 2 months' time, we should have all of those out in public as well.
And who provides the infrastructure for CentOS, the CentOS project?
That's a good question. It's we're in a very unique position. I don't know anybody else who is in this sort of a position in that the entire hardware, the entire infrastructure, the entire network is donated to us. We actually have no cost of running the project.
Wow, nice one.
And we have 100-plus servers.
Wow.
In 48-plus data centers in 19 different countries.
That is impressive work.
Fantastic.
And we have no cost.
And I assume that's including your mirror network and your build servers and everything for the CentOS project.
This is only the mirrors that we run ourselves, so mirrors which are within CentOS.org.
Okay, but other people can, like universities or whatever,
there's something like, I think, 200 plus external mirrors, which are all, well, external mirrors.
Fantastic.
Things like mirror service and, you know, kernel.org and stuff like that.
And to do all this, to support all these versions for 11 years and to provide all this infrastructure and maintain and manage it and to develop the distro, how big is the community around CentOS?
The user community is quite large. The developer community, on the other hand, is probably maybe 24 people at the moment.
Wow.
Is that because it's hard to say, you don't really need to, because this is going to sound pejorative, but you feed off of Red Hat.
For the core distribution, yes. We do a couple of other things, you know, like it's one of the big differences between us and them, as in them being Red Hat, is that at the end of the day, it's a community. So if you want to do stuff like, you know, RHEL only ships with PHP 5.1.6, which not a lot of people want to use anymore. So somebody can stand up and say, look, I'll maintain a PHP 5.2.9 or a 5.3.0.
Right.
And, you know, as long as somebody else can set up the QA spec as to what all it should be able to do, we accept the packages. One of the things is, of course, somebody else has to write the QA spec.
Right.
As long as the guy doing it. And we've got a custom kernel there. We've got hardware support for loads of other things like RAID cards, HBS, which are not included in the RHEL kernel. And they're all available there. So, yeah, it's a pretty small group there. It's a pretty small group of people.
We've had a question from one of our listeners, JA Web Design, on Twitter, asking, we talked a bit about CentOS being used for servers and in data centers for enterprise use. How do you think it compares for people who are non-developers? Is CentOS a good distribution for using on the desktop?
For people who are not very technical, CentOS is definitely a good option, because once you've got it on, you don't have to worry about updates, you don't have to worry about system changes for as long as you really want to. At least 4 to 5 years. If you're happy with what it's doing, you don't have to worry about it breaking down. You don't have to worry about, you know, a particular update breaking something else or something that's working today going away, stuff like that. So it's pretty much like the Ubuntu LTS stuff. So once you've got it on there, it'll just stay working.
Right.
Which is definitely good for people who are not very technical, you know, because they don't want to be sort of messing about with you know, that a kernel update yesterday sort of broke something else, or a security patch to OpenSSH broke something else.
Yeah, there certainly are people out there who like stability.
Yeah, we rightly so.
We've had another question via Identica this time from Techno Viking, who asks, how does Red Hat feel about CentOS, and who's the best known entity that uses CentOS as their main distro?
Wow.
How does Red Hat feel about it? I think you'll have to ask them, but... feedback that we get from the developers, people who are working, you know, the Red Hat engineering teams, they don't mind, because we feed patches back to them, we feed bug reports back to them, you know, and a lot of times, because we have our own QA process, we find a lot of things that their QA process missed.
Wow.
And we feed it back to them before their users get to it, you know, and a couple of times they fix stuff for us upstream. You know, and so the engineering team is quite happy with us. The marketing and sales, I don't know. I'm not so sure about that.
Well, you can understand it. You know, they've got a product to sell, and they've got, you know, a bottom line to reach. So
I seem to remember reading about a process you could actually turn a CentOS server into a Red Hat Enterprise Linux server via their process. That they actually provided ways of doing that. So in many ways, CentOS might actually aid their marketing if they want support.
That's
there's
true.
An easy
That's
way
true.
To do it.
That's true. I mean, we've heard rumors of companies who've had a major problem and they just don't have the technical expertise in-house being able to call Red Hat, and Red Hat saying, fine, you buy licenses and we'll fix your machine for you.
The other part of Mike's question related to, you know, what large customers, I guess it's tricky to say because you're a community distro. You know, it's not something you can very easily say who uses it unless you know, that's something you do know and you use that in your promotion. I don't know.
In terms of numbers, large, or larger than, you know, a company that everybody's heard of, I don't know. We know that EDS use a lot of CentOS.
Right.
We know that there's a person called Boris somewhere in Russia who works for a petroleum
Funny
company.
That.
And he runs a cluster of about 2,200 cores.
Whoa.
Wow.
Sorry, who did you say he worked for? I didn't catch that.
So these are the two big. I mean, EDS as in, you know, somebody who's big, whom I've heard of, who most of the people would have heard of.
Wow.
I think Boris, whom nobody's heard of ever before, has got a really big cluster sitting somewhere in Siberia, probably.
Yeah, probably just to keep warm.
Fantastic. There's one other thing I just wanted to touch on briefly, and that was one of the reasons why, you know, CentOS has come into the news is one of the issues of the CentOS project leadership. And I just wondered if you could kind of summarize what's been going on and where you are and where you'd like to be in terms of that leadership.
Yeah, I think, like I said earlier, the development team, the core team is very small, which is why if one person suddenly goes missing and, you know, he's not really contactable for a period of time, it could have, you know, major implications in that it creates a bit of a black hole in the whole ecosystem where nobody else has had access to that information and nobody else has looked into it. And now nobody can because the person who was doing it has gone away. And that's the sort of situation we landed up in. And, it's a process that we're on right now. We realize that we've made a couple of mistakes and that when the project started, it started with 3-4 people and just grew from there. And as people came on board, nobody looked back and, you know, sort of thought about what's happening with the organization from the admin point of view, from the finances point of view, from the marketing point of view.
Right.
Which is why we got into a situation where there was a bit of a black hole in that area, which is always concerning because, you know, at the essence of what the project is, it is that stuff which is keeping the project together. Of course, the open letter went down well in that we actually found the person. And he was able to attend a meeting with us on Friday where we sort of brought up all the issues. We haven't resolved all the stuff because that's going to take a bit of time. But we have started a process where we are sort of setting up a council. We'll probably move towards a foundation soon.
Okay.
And we'll try and create a loop where we can bring in certain, you know, sort of have people come in and talk to us about, you know, how to better manage finances, how to better manage projects even, how to better manage even technical know-how, and how to make sure that, you know, we don't get into this sort of a situation again before.
Sure.
It's sort of something we're working on now. I think in a couple of weeks' time, we should be in a much better position.
Do you think this might be a fairly typical scenario that sort of startup distros might go through?
I think so. Not only distros, I think pretty much any and every project out there who doesn't sort of address this at the right time risks being in the situation.
It's going to be very difficult, though, isn't it? Because, you know, we're another example of a small group of people, and the more we do it, the more complex it gets. But I don't know that it's written down, the procedure, or what you know, the best practice is written down anywhere. Do you think that the CentOS project team might actually put something down on a website somewhere saying, you know, this is some things you really should consider.
What the process is.
Yeah, the process and how you should manage your project to make sure that things shouldn't, can't, won't fail.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting you mentioned that. Earlier in the day today, we had a conversation with a couple of people at the SBI. We're going to be talking to a couple of other organizations like this, and we're going to try and actually bring them together, which is interesting because they've never spoken to each other. Like the Linux Fund and the SBI don't always, they're not always at the same wavelength even. So we're going to try and get them together and try and see how we could document best practices.
Excellent.
On open source management. We're lucky in that we've got a couple of big companies who use CentOS who are quite concerned by what was happening.
Mm.
And some of them have offered management resources to say, look, somebody can come across and spend a week, 10 days with you guys to see what you're up to and then make recommendations on that process.
That's great.
And there's some big companies. I mean, think about, let's say, the top five consulting companies in the world and things like that. So which completely throws us because we don't realize who are the people out there who use it.
Yeah.
So when somebody like that comes knocking on your door, you're like, oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, I actually know quite a few applications that actually ship an installation media based on CentOS with their product. So, I mean, CentOS is actually really in there with a lot of projects that want to do that. So I imagine they are quite concerned, but it's good news that this is getting resolved, really.
I think the media also blew it up a bit, and the slashdot headline didn't help anyone.
Yeah.
I don't think it was really that bad as a lot of people thought it was. The project wasn't going anywhere. The infrastructure was still there. The people who were behind it were still there. And
well, it certainly got... I mean, well, they say there's no such thing as bad publicity.
That's true. There's just, yeah.
You could do without the stress, though, I'm sure.
That's true, yeah. We had a couple of sleepless nights when people were calling up and people you never heard of before saying, are you looking for a job? Are you not being paid anymore? And you said, well, you know what? I was never paid by CentOS, didn't I?
Thank you for your concern.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, thank you for taking the time to talk to us today and clearing up some of the things that CentOS has been looking at and what it is and how it all works and hangs together. It's been really interesting to hear from you, and especially as an Ubuntu podcast, it's great to get a view from outside the Ubuntu community about some of the other exciting things that are going on there.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Thanks for having me on. Good talking to you guys.
So if people want to try CentOS or they want to get involved, how can they do that?
Go to the wiki.centos.org. And there are titles there which should give you pretty much all the information you need on how to get started, how to get help, how to get the distribution, people you can talk to, stuff like that.
Excellent. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Cheers, Gabby. Cheers.
Bye.
Goodbye.
The first long-term support edition of Ubuntu 6.06 has reached end of life on the desktop. This means that bugs and security issues will not be addressed, presumably unless those packages happen to be in the server version. It will continue to be supported on the server for another 2 years.
That's till 2011, isn't it? Yeah.
Goodbye to the very first LTS desktop.
And actually, Dapper was the first one. It felt a bit clean, actually. You know, that to me was the first one that really felt a bit polished.
Well, it was Dapper.
Mm, that was the first one that was delayed as well, wasn't it?
Yes, yes. It didn't
6 weeks?
Yeah.
Lots of firsts.
Bye-bye, Dapper Drake. Who's got the hoisin sauce?
Microsoft have contributed some code for their virtualization system Hyper-V to the Linux kernel. This, in turn, has caused some comment and consternation for those who suspect Microsoft of dirty tricks or not abiding by the terms of the GPL.
Yeah, big ding-dong, lots of people getting very cross.
That's quite fun.
Didn't it later materialise that they actually released it because if they hadn't released it, they would have made to release it because it was GPL code they were using anyway?
Yeah, they needed to have released it, but they did. So, good stuff.
Everything's okay.
Improves the kernel, improves the use of Linux VMs under Hyper-V. Good stuff.
The Debian project has announced that it will be introducing time-based freezes, not, as widely reported, time-based releases. The freeze will allow developers to concentrate on release critical bugs and will take place in December every other year. The exact release date will still depend on how quickly the release critical bugs are resolved.
Yeah, so they're still going to release when ready, it's just they've got a target for starting that process.
Okay.
So the first one will be in December this year. And then it'll be every 2 years after that. So it means you should see a release of Debian every couple of years.
give or take a few
months. I did see an interesting interesting blog post about this relating to the timing and how it would impact on when you get certain packages in Ubuntu and when you get them in Debian, and whether you'd actually end up being worthwhile running Debian at all if stuff arrives in Ubuntu first.
But Ubuntu's always taken from unstable.
Yeah, and it was very confusing for me because I couldn't quite get the grasp of when this stuff lines up. But yeah, it's worth reading. I'll put a link in the show notes. Pygame 1.9.0 has been released, and if you can think of anything interesting to say about a development library, please write it here. Oh, was I not supposed to read that?
Congratulations to the people who work on Pygame, I guess.
I put that in there because, I have a little soft spot for Pygame because it's quite a nice little environment to develop.
I have soft spots for things I've never used as well.
I won't show you my games I've written.
I'm sorry.
CentOS, the compatible but fee-free version of Red Hat Enterprise Linux, has had a leadership crisis after key contributor Lance Davis disappeared, taking with him control of the CentOS.org domain, project funds and rights to the IRC channel. This prompted an open letter to Davis from the key developers on the CentOS website, but the issues are now being resolved.
Yeah, it looks like they've had a conflab with him, and everything seems to be on the way to being sorted.
It is odd that one of the key concerns is control of the IRC channel. You know, I mean, to actually raise that as a valid, you know, oh, what are we going to do? The operator from the channel's gone.
It does raise a lot of questions about projects who rely on one person often in the very early days and how they can make sure that turns into a sustainable community.
Well, we have that exact, you know, potential issue in Mark Shuttleworth.
Yeah, I mean, we've got the Ubuntu Trust Foundation. That's the one. Yes. Yeah, that's supposed to be able to take over. But
even if it did take over, that wouldn't run Ubuntu for years and years and years.
Not in its current form, I agree. But I mean, we would obviously ship it. Would be the main thing to stop. And you know,
and Canonical as a going concern may well find difficulty funding itself. Yeah, it's certainly yours.
Let's not speak a lot about open source projects as a whole. I mean, should they be controlled by, you know, one uber geek at the top? Surely it should all be distributed so that when the guy at the top says, nah, not anymore, can't be bothered.
But that's where the license is supposed to come in. So you've got an open code repository, anybody can just take it and carry on.
Yeah, but just organisationally, I mean, take us four, for example.
Mm.
If you can't be bothered next week, then we could move on because that's the way we've always set it up so that it's a seamless organisation.
But Tony would take his mixer and go home like a fool.
Okay, so it wouldn't work in that instance.
The popular open source gallery software Gallery has launched a survey asking anyone who shares photos online to take part.
What's it about?
It's about what people want to get out of online photo resources. So not just people who are currently using Gallery, but if you use Flickr or SmugMug or any of the other photo sharing sites, they want to know your opinion. You know, in the long run, hopefully, to get more Gallery users. I think they realised that Gallery 2 was a bit overcomplicated.
It's very heavy on resources, isn't it?
I think so, yeah. And they want to find out what they can do with Gallery 3 to make it more attractive to people.
Is Gallery 3 under development then?
Mm, yeah.
Oh, right.
It's looking quite nice, apparently.
Oh, cool.
As reported on CNET, Matthew Zulick, I presume, Red Hat's former CEO and current chairman, stated that Red Hat spends over $100 million a year to advance Linux and open source, mainly through development.
Wow, that's good
going. That's a lot of money.
Yeah. Anybody know how much Canonical do? Just genuinely out of curiosity.
No idea.
Okay.
But I don't actually know how much 100 million is of a proportion of their revenue. Red Hat's revenue 2009 was $652 million, according to Wikipedia. So that's a fairly big chunk, yeah. The
rest is all profit.
Well, it's free software, so... Miro have released version 2.5, including better podcast support and improved audio playback interface.
Does anyone here use Miro anymore?
No.
I used to, but I stopped because it was a bit too chunky and because I'm evil.
It's now has an improved audio playback interface. Maybe it's less chunky.
Actually, it's supposed to start up a lot quicker.
That was the main thing. I had it loading when you first logged in, and it really is a pain in the desktop to actually do that.
Microsoft have announced that they are opening two Apple-style retail stores.
Yes, the modelled, there's a PowerPoint presentation floating around that shows like the interior and how they have a guru bar, like the Apple Genius bar. They're having a guru bar. Well, maybe we should, you know, open
what, are they gonna call them? Stores. Are they going to call them gurus?
I suspect they probably will, yes.
Yeah. What will we call
them? Oh, God, that's what we have on our T-shirts, Ubuntu Guru.
Guru.
We should go in there with those on and denial of service attack in a Free Software Foundation style.
Yeah. The next Ubuntu UK team meeting will be held by IRC at 8 o'clock PM BST. That's 7 o'clock UTC PM. 1900 hours if you're in the military.
All Ubuntu meetings are quoted in UTC because they're global, you see.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. Apart from the one here that is quoted in BST. Sunday the 9th of August 2009 in #ubuntu-uk on the Freenode IRC network.
That's basically this Sunday.
Yeah, what's going on that meeting then, Dave?
Well, there's an absolute crammed agenda so far. I think mainly talking about the Global Jam. I think that's one of the main things that's covered.
Uh-huh. Ah.
So if you want to participate or observe, then just join the IRC channel, #ubuntu-uk, which is our channel.
Excellent.
Effectively.
Yes.
So you could talk about the podcast afterwards or before if you were that so much.
But not during.
No.
They could if they had it as an agenda item, yes.
Well, it could go in any other items as well.
Of course, yes.
Software Freedom Day this year is Saturday the 19th of September 2009.
The Atlanta Linux Fest is also on the 19th of September at the IBM facility on Northside Parkway.
The Ohio Linux Fest is on the 25th to the 26th of September at Greater Columbus Convention Center in downtown Columbus, Ohio. And we have a trailer we could play here or not.
Come celebrate 40 years of Unix at the Ohio Linux Fest from September 25th through the 27th. If you use GNU Linux, BSD, OpenSolaris, or any Unix or Unix-like system, you belong at Ohio Linux Fest. Register free today at ohiolinux.org.
The whole world is going to be covered in Ubuntu's Global Jam on the 2nd to the 4th of October 2009. Check out the show notes for a link for more info.
I think we've done all the jam games.
I think we should make that a sticky on the actual podcast page.
Oh,
yeah. There's always one more to squeeze out.
Lug Radio Live 2009 will be on the 24th of October in New Hampton Arts Centre, Wolverhampton.
We are, and there might be something happening on the Sunday as well.
Oh, there might be, yes.
Yeah, we're talking with the Linux Outlaws guys. If you're going along to Lug Radio Live or not, and would like to do something on Sunday the 25th of October, probably some sort of informal bar camp type event, let us know if you'll be around, if you'd be interested in going.
Also on the gathering front, FOSDEM next year is on the 6th and 7th of February in the Université Libre Brussels.
Or Brussels, as it says here on this wiki page.
It does.
Well, Brussels actually sounds a lot better, actually.
All right, you go there then, Dave.
Excellent.
Well, look, I couldn't go to FOSDEM this year because I was snowed in. I had like 18 inches of snow. I couldn't go.
Didn't you say that last time?
That's a shame.
Did I?
Yeah.
Right then, it's time for some Command Line love.
That's not what it says on the website.
This is an interesting one. You're sat at your PC and you can't get to the internet, but why not?
Your network cable's not plugged in.
Possibly. Or your router's failed or your switch has failed or something like that. Well, this command basically enables you to check from the terminal whether or not your network cable is in fact attached and at what speed it's synced to your switch, the next thing downstream on your network cable. That's it. Nice and easy.
And it is. I think this is a short enough command line foo that you could actually read it out.
Right. It's the app is MII-tool, me tool. Run it as sudo and it'll basically tell you if your cable is connected, if you're synced, your interface is synced.
Oh, that command was too long for me. Will you put that on the release notes?
I don't know. Ask the bloke who does the release notes.
I think you can also actually use it to set the speed and because I know in the past some switches have had problems detecting whether it's half or full duplex and 10 or 100 and you can actually force your card to be one or other or whatever.
Yeah. So this could be a cheeky way of throttling your kids' PCs. Yeah.
Drop them down to 10 megabit.
Yeah.
Yeah, but how fast is your internet?
I'd have all the bandwidths and they'd have none.
And they'd have 10%.
Yeah.
Put gigabit Ethernet in, him 10 megabit. Can you have gigabit? That's an awesome idea.
And now the second part of our interview with Dustin Kirkland. If you missed the first part, you can hear it in Season 2, Episode 9, The Dimensions of Time. And now, back to the interview.
One other thing, you mentioned remotely administering a number of servers, and I know one of the things you're a key developer of is, now, I'm going to say Biobu. How do you pronounce that?
So I'm not a Japanese speaker, but I have talked to a couple. It's basically two syllables, where the first syllable is kind of one and a half syllables.
You don't know, do you?
Biobu.
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 Okay.
So the B-Y-O is bio, and then B-U, bu.
So what biobu. Is it?
So Biobu is really just a nicer front end for GNU Screen. GNU Screen's been around for 20-something years now, and I think any old school Unix admin worth his salt certainly knows what Screen is, if not uses it on a daily basis.
Mostly to run an IRC client, usually.
That's certainly one use of it. The most useful aspect to me of Screen before I started working on Biobu was to start running something, disconnect, and reconnect later. So I could start running something in the office. I could background that process if I remembered to start Screen before running that download or an rsync or maybe a long build. I could shut down my local laptop, get in the car, drive home, get back home, reconnect, and see where my long-running process was. I could reattach to that same screen. What I came to learn, though, reading the 5,000-line man page, is that Screen's got quite a bit of configuration options, most of which are not unlocked by the majority of Screen users. Also on the web, I found tons of people sharing their Screen RC file, and I started, I kind of wanted to create a best of. And beyond that, sort of a sane default for Ubuntu and for the Ubuntu server. From that, it's really really evolved to a sort of a what I'd like to think is a stock command line window manager for Ubuntu server. Everyone knows Ubuntu server doesn't ship with a graphical interface. Do you really need a graphical interface, or do you just need a window manager? And I think Biobu provides a really neat, lightweight window manager.
No.
Sorry.
Dave and I fighting to get a question. So what, over the top of what Screen already does, which is the ability to detach from something that's already running, what do I get? I've seen this funky stuff along the bottom of the screen. What is that showing me, and what's the benefit of having that?
Right, so there's a couple of key things that Biobu gives you over Screen. First of all, ultimately, Biobu is just a really complex .screenrc file. You can actually flatten that Biobu's configuration to a single screenrc file and then move that file around with you to other Unix or Linux systems that don't have Biobu installed. But ultimately, this provides a couple of things. One is better key bindings. So the key bindings that Screen provides, there's lots of them, but they're sort of arcane. It's control A, caret, dollar, it's complicated.
They are obscure,
Yeah, I've taken the most commonly used ones and mapped them to the F keys, literally F2, F3, F4, F5, F6, F7, and F8 and F9. It's really much easier, single keystrokes. It's keys that hopefully you're not using for other things.
Uh-huh.
You can disable those if you're running a program like Midnight Commander MC that does use that.
Right.
So key bindings is one thing. A second thing is the status bar that we mentioned just a minute ago. So at the very bottom of the screen, there's a list of toggleable status items that you can turn on or turn off at the bottom of your screen. And this consists of things like your memory usage, your CPU speed, your disk usage, users logged on. It's pretty stock stuff, the type of stuff you'd see in Conky or
a graphical toolbar or something. So with all this information down the bottom of the screen, I know some diehard system admins look at that and think, oh my god, colour, or oh my god, information at the bottom of the screen. Why, you know, have you met some resistance from people who, you know, don't like that information on the screen or think it's a waste of screen real estate, for example?
Yeah, I've certainly encountered people who've said that. Some have even called the colors tacky. I won't go that far. In Jaunty, if a user types screen, the first thing they're asked is to select a screen profile. That was sort of our discoverability. How do we make screen profiles, as it was called in Jaunty before we renamed it Biobu? That was our discoverability. That has met more resistance than I initially imagined. Mm-hmm. So we've sort of taken a different approach with Karmic. In Karmic, if you type screen, you get screen, the old screen. Your screen sort of flashes once and your running screen, there's no Biobu status or anything at the bottom. If you type Biobu instead of screen, you get Biobu, which is the more full-featured sort of environment. I guess I didn't explain why the word Biobu. Biobu is a Japanese word for sort of the decorative folding screen. So those,
right,
you know, like the elegant, painted, sort of fancy screens that you might find in a room.
In a pagoda or something.
Yeah, so it's sort of a fancier, more elegant screen is really where the name comes from.
So to keep the diehard system admins happy, you've got normal screen, and for us that like a little bit of bling, there's Biobu with the nice colours. Is there like halfway in between? Can I customise it so that I have, you know, the information presented at the bottom of the screen but with no colour, for example?
The last thing that Biobu does as it loads all of the bits and pieces of the configuration files is it sources your .screenrc file. So you can put any overrides you want in that file, and it will override anything that was previously set within screen's limitations, of course. But for the most part, that's how I test new features before I'm ready to unleash them on other users. I'll just add bits and pieces and snippets into my .screenrc file and relaunch Biobu, and it'll basically tack that on to the end. That said, now if users do want to type screen and actually get Biobu, it's trivial for them to do that. They just need a symbolic link from their .screenrc file pointing to their .biobu profile.
Cool.
So then at that point you can just type screen and launch actually Biobu.
And from a real simple user's point of view, you and I have been working together a bit with the documentation, but the great thing about Biobu is that it's all done in shell scripts, so it's actually quite easy to get in there and change things yourselves.
Yeah, that's right. So thanks, Simon. Simon has helped quite a bit in getting the documentation into a format that hopefully users can read and understand.
Although I'm slacking a bit at the moment, I know, but there you go.
It's looking good. I'm really pleased someone was able to help. Help with the documentation aspect, but yeah, the idea is to make screen more accessible to users without having to read thousands of lines of a shell man page, and to be able to do simple window management in a command line interface without thinking about it very much.
We've had a number of questions from the world of Twitter and Identica, and one of which is just touched on the final product. Josh Holland has asked, are we going to see eCryptFS as a default anytime soon? So what is eCryptFS to start off with?
So eCryptFS is, another project that I've worked on and maintained upstream for a couple of releases now. We started in... eCryptFS is a cryptographic file system. It's actually in the Linux kernel itself. So there's a lot of encrypted file systems and different ways of doing encryption. With eCryptFS, the couple of key features, each individual file is encrypted as opposed to, say, the entire device, the entire block device being encrypted. There's a couple of things I like about that. One is that you can move those files around, so you can rsync individual files as opposed to rsyncing an entire, multi-gigabyte encrypted LVM volume. Also, it means that if a couple of bits go wrong somewhere in, let's say, a backup or something like that, you don't lose all of your data. You lose that file, but it's much better than, try taking a giant GPG'd file, twiddling one bit, and see what happens. You can't encrypt that file at all. It's also in the kernel, so it's quite performant compared to some other encryption solutions. So in Intrepid, we embarked on some work on the server team called the Encrypted Private Directory. Users can optionally set up a single folder inside of their home directory called Private, and your home private directory would be eCryptFS mounted automatically when you logged in, and you could optionally store your most sensitive, most critical data there. And what we ended up doing in the Intrepid timeframe, some of us would put stuff like our .evolution directory, our .firefox directory, and so forth, .ssh, for instance, in the private directory, and then symlink them back to where they expect it to be.
So it appears to actually be there.
Yeah, so the various programs, Evolution and so forth, looking for a .evolution directory, it would just chase down that symlink, and the data that got written to disk would be encrypted, but it wouldn't be able to look for it in its normal location. Why use this over full disk encryption? Full disk encryption certainly has its benefits, and there are places where it might make sense to continue using that. But for one thing, when you turn on your computer with full disk encryption, your computer will immediately start asking you for a password at the very beginning. And mm-hmm. So some of the work we've done getting the boot speeds down to 5 or 10 seconds in Ubuntu, you lose that if you're waiting at a prompt before you've even booted the system, right? So the key here was to actually use the passphrase that you have to enter anyway when you log into the system, and use that to mount an encrypted private directory. In Jaunty, it wasn't that difficult for me to extend that work. Instead of just encrypting home/private, to encrypt all of home. And that's worked pretty well. There's a bit of polish that we've needed to do before we make it a default, like your user asked. In fact, I don't think we'll ever get to a point where we're going to make that a default. I think there's just too many Ubuntu installations out there where no encryption is really required at all. But there are many users who do want that. And
we'll have it as a tick box in the live installer, perhaps?
Yeah, exactly. So in Jaunty, you had to enter a special parameter, kernel parameter, on the live CD boot line, user setup equals encrypted home or something like that.
I didn't know you could do that.
Yes, I've actually got to look it up. I've blogged about it. I've got to chase down my blog every time I need to do it because it's a little bit cryptic, but the...
Excuse the pun.
Yeah, there we go. So it is not easily discoverable, but it's there. Basically, if you add that line on your kernel boot, cool. When you get to the page where you're choosing your username and your password, there will be an option at the bottom which says, require a password to log in and decrypt the contents of my home directory on the radio. Log in automatically, which is no password, and that's obviously incompatible with encrypting a home directory because you have to have a password to
encrypt. Yeah, sure.
Right? The second option is require a password to log in. The third option is require a password to log in and decrypt my home directory. So that option was obscured in the default desktop install. My goal for Karmic, and I still have a lot of work to do before we can make that happen. My goal for Karmic is for that to at least be an option in the default desktop installation.
Great.
Now, Dustin, talking of your blog and various encryption things, I remember some months ago you actually set a challenge, basically trying to open the encryption to the masses. do you want to explain the concepts behind that, and whether you're going to set another one?
Yeah, so that it was a lot of fun, actually. It was kind of a weird coincidence. So I read a really good book of fiction late last year. It's called Daemon by Daniel Suarez. Really smart kind of cyber thriller, I guess. I traded a couple of emails with the author, Basically said, hey, good book, enjoyed it. I sent it from an Ubuntu.com address. His response was, it warms my heart that my book struck a chord in the open source community.
Aww.
And that started a neat little dialogue. So he sent me his publisher sent me a couple of copies of the book with the stipulation that I give it away in a contest of some kind on my blog. And the publisher didn't really make any requests. I asked for more information, and she just said, I'll just give it away. I don't really care how, but make it a contest, make it something fun. And so during the Christmas break, I spent some time and created a series of three different challenges, where these challenges, the first one was pretty simple. It was basically set up an encrypted home directory, hash a couple of things that would hash to a known value that I knew, use that hash to decrypt a file, and answer a riddle inside of that file and send the secret email address that was in the encrypted file the answer. And the first person who does that wins a copy of the book.
So did Dave win the book?
Did Dave win the book? I don't think Dave won the book.
No, I only asked that because I know he didn't.
I think Dave may have been the only person who actually solved all three challenges.
Wow.
Win.
Yeah. So,
yeah, he did something right.
But the thing is, for future competitions, can I just request that you actually think about the British people and actually, you know, don't release it sort of in the early afternoon, release it in the morning, because otherwise people spend up, you know, perhaps staying up till 4 in the morning or something silly.
People being with you.
I think I would take that into consideration, except that two of the three winners were from the UK, and I did not take that into account as I ran this contest, and it cost me $1.25 to ship it to Iowa or wherever the third one went to, but the first two I think cost more than the book to ship.
we feel your pain.
Yeah, we should have been there. For what was worth, the one you sent me was obviously the American edition, and all the Americanisms of the American way of spelling things I found infuriating as
I
went through the book.
Lord, he just
but thank you very much, Dustin.
He's never grateful. I think that's everything we wanted to.
Yeah, that's really good. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks, guys. I really appreciate the opportunity. I love listening to the podcast.
Oh, that's very kind of you to say.
And on a very important note, is your hair still long or have you had it cut?
Oh, my hair is very short now.
Okay.
So anyway,
the incisive question.
It's summertime. It's quite hot in Austin. 106 or something insane like that right now.
Wow.
Excellent.
Well, thanks for joining us, Dustin. It's been great having you on.
Thank you very much.
Guys.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.
It's time for some swag. It's that competition time. £20 worth of goodies from the Canonical shop is available. One of the one of our old vouchers.
Yeah. Old ones.
One of our old ones. Yeah, just a few spare ones.
The return
around.
Of the much-loved Canonical shop voucher.
Yeah, just we thought we'd do something slightly different with this one as well.
Bit wacky.
So we're going to give you the answer.
And you've got to tell us the question.
Be as inventive as you like, but bear in mind, if we're going to read them out, they have to be, you know, Ubuntu Code of Conduct friendly and not contain any swearing.
Because swearing does, in fact, upset us as well.
Of course it does.
So the answer is Pulse Audio. What's the question?
Send your questions to competition@ubuntu-uk.org by Monday the 17th of August.
And anybody can enter this competition. It's open to the whole world as long as you've got an email address.
It's been called many things, including Gerald, Harold, Phyllis, Dustosphere, and my original Ecosphere, which I still think is valid.
But it's not.
Okay. So the first post we have in the Margaret...
Margaret
is a post that was made to the Ubuntu UK mailing list about something called GNOME Global Menu. Dave, you put this in here.
Yeah. It seems to be a way. I mean, on all your applications, you've always got this sort of file edit and all the different options at the very top of the menu.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a concept that seems to be come from the Mac operating system is rather than having it on each application, it adds it to the very top. So it adds it to where the menu is.
Oh, the thing at the very, very top of the screen.
Yeah, so your application.
Right. And it's locked to the top of the screen.
Yeah. So you actually waste quite a lot of space in your own application there. And
what, the one line in each window that has the file menu?
Well, yeah, yeah. I mean, it does sound like quite a nice idea. It's a unified place as
well.
So this
thing lets you do that on Ubuntu.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, the reason I really brought this up wasn't specifically just to talk about that particular entry. It was also thinking about, well, there are, I mean, the difference between Ubuntu and Debian is Ubuntu tries to pick the best things of all the free software things and put them in one installation.
Yeah.
Now, what do you other people think about actually using non-defaults and things like that? I mean, what's the long-term effects of doing that?
Surely you do that anyway. First thing you do after you install is add other stuff.
Yeah, but when it's something quite critical to the actual desktop there, presumably that actually replaces something. I haven't actually tried it, but presumably it actually replaces something else.
Right.
So then you're actually being asked to remove Ubuntu desktop metapackage, aren't you?
I don't know. I've not tried it.
Well, I mean, as a long as other concept, I mean, you probably find things where that has happened with other applications.
Do you mean, is it significant if Ubuntu chooses to differ from the GNOME defaults significantly?
No, I think it's the other way. I'm interpreting the question as, does it matter that I am changing my desktop to be different from Ubuntu?
Yeah, I mean, what problems could that cause? I mean, clearly, you're probably not going to get the updates and things like that if you've installed it from a third-party source.
Well, I guess that's a question for our listeners, really. What do they do? Because, I mean, we all modify ours. I mean, you're running Crunchbang. Yours looks like you're using a Dust theme there, slightly different from the normal. And you've got a very large size panel,
at
the bottom and top of the screen and toolbars and stuff. And I know Tony uses...
Pretty standard.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I actually set up on...
I just use my computer.
I wanted to ask the listeners what they do to their machines that's different from stock Ubuntu. Not just adding packages, but, you know, real, like, hardcore changes, like moving the panel.
Well, I mean, I can actually state that with Mrs. Davies' laptop, I actually set up Avant navigation bar.
Oh, the window navigator.
Yeah.
Does she listen, though?
Only when I make her.
Well, there's another sort of interesting connotation to that, and as you said, it was a macOS style way of doing this menu bar. And we've already commented in previous episodes that the login screen is very macOS style,
and the Avant window navigator that Dave chose is that the thing
that looks like the dock at the bottom?
Dock at the bottom screen, yeah.
Is Ubuntu increasingly following the macOS design model?
Yes, there are so many things that are following that. But anyway, yeah,
compass.
If we ask, yes.
Is it a good thing? You can't just make a noise.
Well, you're asking the guy who's bought a Mac. So
and owns how many iPods?
Two. One of them was given to me, though.
Freedom.
Okay, well, perhaps listeners will let us know if they think it's a good thing, if we're following the Mac.
Not
OS
if
design.
It's a good thing that Alan has a Mac. If it's a good thing that people, you know, change their stuff, and also if it's a good thing if people are moving towards a Mac look.
And if you do try different things, what different things do you try?
Yeah.
Cyril Brulbois, I almost certainly pronounced that incorrectly, posted on the Debian Devel list. He maintains the Blender packages, and he'd like to know what to do with packages like Blender, where it's not quite abandonware, but where the upstream community isn't particularly interested in helping people package it and get it into distributions. So he says that they don't really care about being distributed. They want people to download it from Blender's website, and they don't worry about security patches particularly. They've obviously got their own priorities that aren't security, and these sort of embedded code and things like that, which obviously makes it difficult for distributions like Debian to distribute it. And things like Sinalera do the same thing as well, with sort of embedded binaries and things like that that make it difficult to do.
And Handbrake does as well. They bundle in their own FFmpeg and the libav codecs that go with it and stuff, and that makes it hard. Handbrake isn't even in Debian or Ubuntu in the repos, I think partly for that reason. But Blender is, and I think this post was talking about the possibility of orphaning the package and not putting it in Debian anymore. And if it's not in Debian, then it probably won't be in Ubuntu.
It basically sounds like he's had enough, really, of trying to keep it all together.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, quite a few applications actually pin to a specific version of certain libraries and things like that.
Yeah, but that's different. That's pinning it. So
what I mean is, if it says it requires version X.Y...
No, that's not the same.
Then they have to ship their own, don't they?
No, that's not what this is saying. He's saying that in the package that you get with Blender, you get the FFmpeg libraries. It's not a separate "this package depends on FFmpeg."
Blah. Oh yeah, no, no. Oh, sorry, I know what you're saying. I'm saying the same thing. I'm saying, well, if they actually do depend on a specific version, then it actually does make sense in some ways to actually ship the version within the actual application.
Yeah, I'm not sure they actually depend on a specific version and more their own patches that they've put in that specific
That's
version.
That's nice. I really like that.
And then you've got to get security fixes into the bundled version as well. Oh, yeah. You know, it's just a nightmare.
Yeah.
But it goes to show there's a lot of work going into these sort of very complex packages. And
it's not always as straightforward as one thinks, because I mean, I asked about having Handbrake packaged, and a lot of people kind of went, oh, God, no, because of the problem with, you know, having extra stuff bundled in with it. And Handbrake is much the same. The upstream don't really care about having it packaged.
Alan Lord, the open sorcerer, successfully gets a refund for his Windows license from Amazon. He blogs about it on his blog.
That's a good place for it.
Yeah, yeah. Smart move. Yeah. Yeah, he was quite chuffed with this.
Yeah, he basically phoned them up, I think, and said,
yeah,
I don't want to use this Windows thing that came with my... It was a netbook, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I haven't accepted the end-user license agreement, and it says I can get a refund if I don't accept it.
Because it actually says that in Microsoft's license terms, doesn't it? If you don't accept it, you can ask for a refund.
No, it doesn't. It specifically says if you don't accept the license, return the product, is what it says. Mm. And by saying return the product, it isn't explicitly saying return Windows.
Whether it means the hardware or just the software.
Right,
element.
In their interpretation is return the whole thing. Yeah, but yeah, he got, what was it, £40 or something like for that. XP Home license.
Now, a few people have done this, and they've also done it with Dell and things like that. But it's the first time I've heard of it from Amazon.
Yeah, the unfortunate thing is someone else asked a few days later, and they said no.
Yeah, and
I was going to say, I wonder what Amazon do with the licenses. I wonder what Dell do with the licenses.
I suspect
they just
they just write it off, to be honest.
Yeah. Mm. I'd be surprised if it ever gets back to Microsoft. I don't think they ever tell them in any way. I mean, the guy from, I think it was Sheffield last year, maybe 2 years ago, who got a refund from Dell for his XP license. I'm pretty sure Dell actually wrote to him and said it's a payment in gratuity. It's not a refund. They never actually said it was a refund. They said it was a gratuity payment, which technically means they're not going to ask Microsoft for that because it doesn't say refund.
Yeah, but what I think they're really saying is so they don't form a company precedent for that.
Sure.
I think that's the main reason for saying that, is so he doesn't publish that letter and say, well, if he got it. So doing it as a goodwill gesture is...
Yeah. It's not a very sustainable model for the hardware manufacturers, is it? If they're paying £40 to Microsoft for the license, and then for a proportion of those machines, they have to pay £40 to the user in addition... I mean, the overheads or the profit margins on these hardware things are so small anyway, it's going to easily wipe out any profit from those. And if Ubuntu or Linux carries on getting more and more popular and more people want their license money back, it's not a sustainable model.
There's a new news website for Debian. It's at news.debian.net. It's completely unofficial, apparently.
Mm.
Yeah, it's got quite a few interesting news things about it, about DebConf on there.
Yeah, I think it's comparable with the Ubuntu news website, which is called The Fridge.
Yeah. There are free copies of the official Ubuntu book available for loco teams. John O'Bacon, the bearded community wrangler, blogged about it. And I think you get a copy of the book for each loco, is that right?
There's two books.
Two books?
Yeah, two books.
Oh, there's an orangey one and a reddy one.
A serve one and desktop one, isn't there?
And well, yeah, that's the technical description. Orangey and reddy, I prefer.
And we're also getting a couple for the podcast as well. Giveaway in the competition,
which incidentally they haven't replied to my email yet.
I'm keeping them. We're not giving away
another prize that goes into Simon's
book. Simon's very big bookshelf.
Time for your feedback now, and Nathan Howard has emailed in to let us know that he found this show on Miro. Oh, we were just talking about that earlier in the news, and he's listened to the entire archive, which is well beyond the Call of Duty, I think. And he's now bang up to date. He also lets us know that the oldest computer he runs Ubuntu on is an Abacus. And he sent us a photo of it booting up a distro called Abantu, as in Abacus and Ubuntu, which we'll put on the website.
Do you think listening to all the old episodes sent him over the edge?
I think it might have done.
Dave Hibbert's emailed in about the Ubuntu Certified Professional Qualification. He says, I work for a Wintel sysadmin at a bank who has been looking at changing to an open source for a number of years. My question is, do you think due to the recession, more big businesses will start looking at open source and Ubuntu Server as a viable business model? Do you think it would be advantageous to study for the Ubuntu Certified Professional exam as a result?
Good question.
Big businesses.
How much is support for Ubuntu Server? How much is support for Microsoft 2003 Server?
Well,
How many Microsoft admins can you pick up for 10 a penny these days?
Oh, yeah, but if the bank itself is looking at moving, it makes sense to have... If the bank's made the decision to go, for whatever reason, and there might be scalability or whatever...
Yeah, stability, there security. Are obviously technical reasons why you might move to Ubuntu Server. I'm just wondering if the financial reasons are immediately obvious.
We haven't actually mentioned this, but there was... remember, you used to see in the trade rags about the London Stock Exchange being all run on Microsoft infrastructure... It was
big in a lot of trade press.
It was, and they had adverts about it. Well, they're throwing it all out now because it all crashed.
Oh, good.
On one day, and they lost a lot of trade. So they're putting all Linux stuff in its place, apparently.
Mm-hmm. And it was Linux-based previously, wasn't it?
So there are financial institutions that are using Red Hat and things primarily, I suspect, to run all their stuff. So if your business is looking at going over to open source, and it's Ubuntu that they're looking at in this particular case, hey, yeah, get certified.
Yeah, magic.
Make yourself indispensable in this economic time.
but I would imagine, particularly as Ubuntu's really powering out the cloud at the moment, compared to a lot of other distributions.
Yeah, I'm not sure how many banks would run on the cloud, but...
Well, no, on their own private cloud.
Oh, right.
Bod Suta emailed to tell us about a new community-created tutorial website for Ubuntu called ubuntuts.com. That was close. The tutorials cover things like programming in Python and installing applications.
Yes, they're text-based tutorials rather than sort of video or audio or anything.
All right. So we've got Show Me Do for the video ones and then Ubuntuts for the text-based ones.
Yes, and somebody emailed in who'd been listening to all the old Season 1 shows again. I don't think it was the same guy as the earlier on in this thing. He's saying, what was the name of that company that does all the videos? Ah. And it's showmedo.com.
Laura Tchaikovsky, see, I got the name right there, wrote to tell us about a new website to help people find out about open source events near them. Laura writes, FossEvents.org is an open source event aggregation site created by the Peer Directed Project Center, a not-for-profit organization that operates Freenode. Our goal with this new site is to make it easy to find open source events near you that interest you. Many of us have missed events that were right around the corner because we didn't know about them until it was way too late. It's a really funky site, isn't it?
It's pretty good, and it's a really good idea, I've got to say. There aren't all that many events on it just yet, but it would be great to see it flourish in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's no reason why we can't put, events in there for UK, and other people put stuff from other regions in there, and it just bulks up to be, a global
resource. Do you think this could go accurate enough to actually have just a normal monthly lug meet on there?
Yeah, absolutely. That's the sort of thing they've got on there. It's not big conferences and expos. Well, it's not just big conference and expos. They've got, lug meetings here, there and everywhere, or, smaller scale events as well, if you're having an install fest or something
like that. Well, I've not looked at it yet, but is it searchable by location? So if I'm going to go to Manchester next week, can I throw Manchester in there and it'll show me what's going on in Manchester for the next 2 weeks?
It's pretty early days, but I think that's where they're aiming for. I think at the moment it's kind of country
And date-based. So you could click on the date and say, I'm going to be there that date, and then see what's
happening
that day.
The dating stuff's in there,
So I can actually add, an install fest at Tony's house on the 29th, and everyone would come to your house on the 29th.
Yes.
Are we going to have one of these events like they have in the newspapers about people turning up to Facebook parties at Tony's house? Hey, I heard there was going to be an install fest.
Yes, you're not invited, any of you. I'm even thinking about the people who are in this room right now, to be honest.
Thanks for listening, and thanks to everyone who took part via Twitter and Identica. If you'd like to get hold of us on email, you can do so via podcast@ubuntu-uk.org or leave 30 seconds of voicemail on 0845 508 1986. Please do. Nobody does.
I would like to receive one voicemail before the next episode recording. That's your challenge.
All right, I'll phone up.
Again, excluding people in this room. You can send us your comments on Identica via identi.ca/UUPC or Twitter, which is twitter.com/UUPC, as well as getting updates from recording sessions and your chance to put questions to our interviewee guests.
Mm. Alternatively, if you're into IRC, you can chat to us via the #Ubuntu-UK channel on the Freenode IRC network.
Do you want a Facebook fan page? Search for Ubuntu a UK podcast. How many are you up to, Tony?
Apparently we have got an awesome 175.
Oh, come on, 200.
Rocketing up.
Let's see if we get 200 by the end of the year.
We welcome suggestions, material tips, reviews or rants and feedback, both positive and negative, so please do get in touch.
Thanks also to our network of community mirrors listed on the website.
We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye. Oh, thanks for listening.